Hello, everybody. Thanks once again for joining us on our ICC podcast. This is Daniel Bagheri, your host. I have once again with me Dr. Catherine Richardson, Director of First People Studies, co-founder of the Center for Response-Based Practices, leader in her community, in her Métis community, and an active member of the Indigenous communities in Canada. Before I open the space up for Dr. Kathy Richardson to lead us through a prayer, I would like to also propose a land acknowledgement. I acknowledge that I'm here on the Kaw land, here in the state of Kansas. I am working here, acknowledging that I am on occupied territory. And as an ally and a person who works with Indigenous nations, we honor the ancestors, the Kaw people, and the generations before and the future that will come. Many thanks, Dr. Richardson, for joining me. I'd like to open the space for you so you can lead us through a prayer and perhaps give us a little bit of your background, the work you do, and then perhaps we can start talking about the very important day, the 30th of September, of the Truth and Reconciliation Day and the importance of it. Dr. Richardson, the space is yours.
No, thank you. So I have a smudge here just to open the space and clear away any negativity. And I just like to acknowledge that I'm on the unceded territory of the Ganiangahaga people here in Jojage, or Muniang, Montreal. And I will start with a prayer from the Cree language. And we will start with acknowledging Kichi Manitou, the Great Spirit. Niwo Atoskeakanak, and the helpers from the four directions, all our spirit guides and ancestors, Kichi Oka Wema, Sacred Mother, Mother Earth, Pachamama, Kanan Skompton, we give thanks to you, Payak Kisikau, for being given one more day on this planet, I Awihian, for loaning it to us, Kakionawa Geminak, all our relations. So thank you, Daniel. It's great to be back on your podcast again. Just to introduce myself a little bit, I'm a member of the Métis Nation in Canada. My Cree name is Kinuiskweu, Golden Eagle Woman. My mother comes from the community of Fort Chipoyan in northern Alberta. So we were fur trade people, and we have Gwich'in and Cree ancestry, as well as some European ancestry. So we're here today to talk about this day of acknowledgement for Indigenous people, to acknowledge the history, to engage in truth-telling, and I guess to think back about the truth and reconciliation process. In Canada, although I don't think reconciliation is an appropriate metaphor, you know, just to start off with that, because it's very mutualizing. It basically means that, you know, two groups of people had a positive and functioning relationship in the past, and then that was broken, and now we're going to repair it back to what it used to be. But unfortunately, and you know, like the history of colonization and genocide, we didn't really ever have a relationship based on equality, mutual respect, and mutual trust, particularly since the founding of Canada nation state in 1867. So there's lots of things to think about today, to reflect upon and acknowledge.
Agreed, absolutely. And thank you for raising that point, that, you know, reconciliation seems to indicate that there was a starting point where there was amicable relationship, but as you pointed out, the history of colonization really started with violence and continues to exert violence on an everyday basis. I understand that's and then can you just tell me, so with the Truth and Reconciliation, for our members who might not be familiar with this process, this is also an active policy being pursued by the government. How does this day relate to the truth and reconciliation process that's undergone in Canada? And if we're going to look at this day critically, do you think this is a national, having a state which is traditionally a perpetuator of violence against colonized people, as the source to promote a national day for truth and reconciliation? Is that helpful or is it beneficial at all? And how do we honor truth and reconciliation? I mean, not a good word, but truth. And honoring Indigenous nations.
And maybe restoration or something. Like
restoration, that. Exactly. How do we honor the ancestors? How do we honor the Turtle Island and its first inhabitants? Well, the original inhabitants of the Turtle Island.
Yeah, well, you raise a really good point because it's about people, right? It's not just about states and who owns land and who has access to mining rights. It's actually about our ancestors and the people that lived on these lands and took care of them since the beginning of human habitation here on Turtle Island, which is the word for basically for North America. And the Indigenous people were residents of Turtle Island. So where do we start? There's so much we can talk about, but we had a government-led Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and some good things came out of that, and there were a number of recommendations, and the ones that I really focus on the most advocated for the reformation of the child welfare system, because that is still the site where the power of the state meets targeted mothers and families and removes their children through the process of applying colonial Western psychology and deciding who's fit to parent their own children. So that's probably the number one recommendation that still needs to be acted on. And I would like to give a little shout out for British Columbia, because that's the one province in Canada that has recently handed over the jurisdiction for child welfare to the Indigenous communities. Now, there's still some, funny issues, like in a way, the practice may not have changed yet. And a lot of the workers that were working for the state moved over, and some of them are working now for Indigenous organizations. So it's going to take generations probably in order to really ground that practice in cultural and community care, but at least that's the first step. So apart from changing child welfare, education is another area of that was addressed in how we need to create more opportunities for Indigenous people to receive education. And I think that means both in mainstream systems, and that means removing a lot of socioeconomic barriers that prevent young Indigenous students from moving to where the institutions are. But it also means having more opportunities to learn or relearn one's own language and study in community programs. For example, Ganawage, they have lots of classes where you can learn Ganiangeha, their Mohawk language. And so now at Concordia, for example, some students have gone to take those classes in the community, and they can get credit for them at the university level if we draw up a sort of independent study plan. So education is an important area, and it's tricky here in Quebec where I live because of the particular politics here. And it's I guess you'd say a Quebecois or French nation, which is different from the rest of Canada. So in their eagerness to preserve their own Quebecois French culture and language, a lot of other Indigenous languages are eclipsed and subjected to increasing forms of repression, I would say. So we need to keep creating more opportunities. And that goes along with EDI, what people are calling, equality and diversity inclusion these days. So creating safe spaces. So I can say we need to, help Indigenous students, move to Montreal to study at the major universities, but that doesn't really reckon in how unsafe and how challenging it is. For example, an Inuk student from the north, from Nunavut or Nunavik, to move to this big city where there's so many challenges, and now it's really hard to get housing and all these things, they make people really unsafe. So we really need to address these social issues before it will be really accessible, you know, for Indigenous students to step into education with ease and support. So those are a few points related Absolutely. To the recommendations. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. And you know, and just for our audience, they might not be familiar. You know, most of the folks who listen to me, many of them come to Canada for the hopes of a better future. I mean, they oftentimes there might be fleeing violence or, you know, economic struggles, hardships in their own countries. You know, so they, you know, for them, it might, when they talk about First Nations, they might not be very familiar with the, of course, the colonial past of in Canada. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you mentioned was a child welfare policy. Yeah. And I know most of my audience may not be familiar with that, but can you speak a little bit about the child welfare policy and how in the past specifically children were targeted among First Nation and Indigenous peoples of Canada?
Yeah.
Why that reform was important that you mentioned?
Sure. And I would say it's probably going on for Native Americans as well, but I'll let you south of the border explore that issue there. So when the, you know, the colonial elites arrived and they set up a state basically for themselves and their friends, people like John A. Macdonald and Donald Smith, who later became Lord Strathcona, and some of these big colonial players, Duncan Campbell Scott. This group of men basically decided that they need to become very wealthy, and right. they wanted to be sort of like the fathers of this new Anglo or English kind of European state here in Canada. And what they needed to do was they needed to get land, and they needed to have land to live on and get their people to come over and populate it. But they also needed to get access to the land so they could go underneath it. And so that means getting, you know, gold and zinc and lead and oil and minerals. So mining was really important. And I think, you know, a lot of that kind of earth exploitation really started in the Industrial Revolution in England and Europe. And so they needed a way. This is what perpetrators do. Mm-hmm. They know that the people they're attacking are going to resist. So they need to suppress the resistance of the people or the targeted victim in advance so that they can get away with their crimes, so that they can get away with their violence and invasion. So they did that through the legal system by just creating random laws that made almost everything illegal for Indigenous people to do. But they decided to target the communities by taking away that which was most precious and sacred. And so in this colonial plan, it was the children. So they decided at some point to go in and remove children. And the big year when this started was about 1958, although there were all sorts of, you know, colonial infractions and violations, you know, from the beginning of the settlement period, I could say. But 1957, the federal government transferred the responsibility for child welfare to each of the Canadian provinces. And so at that moment, the social workers drove into reserves. In the States, you call them reservations. They should be called enclosures, basically, because that was sort of the purpose. And they brought big school buses that were empty, and they just grabbed children and they filled up the buses with the children. And on the West Coast, for example, they sent in planes, you know, float planes, or in the Yukon, it was cattle cars. They just shoved children in here. They did not inform the parents. They certainly didn't ask consent. So the idea was Okay. We'll have this story that we're going to take the children away to educate them because they're, poor lost pagans and they don't have any education. But the real story was we want to destroy this community and cause so much suffering. So they took the children away and then they actually just introduced alcohol in many places right after that and said, I know you're hurting. If you drink this, this will help you. And so they actually created this kind of toxic dependence in some places. And by doing so, they knew they were limiting the community's ability to have an armed resistance or to protest in some way.
Sure,
And then they
sure.
had so many laws, right? So if you tried to hide your children or prevent them from going, the parents would get put in jail or their money from treaty might be cut off. So that's the kind of thing that happened. And the idea was then they could keep reducing the size of the reserves. They could go in and they could open up different mines. And basically, they just wanted to make a lot of money with this discourse of we want to develop the country and indigenous people are in the way. They're in the way of the railroad, they're in the way of progress. And so that's kind of what happened. And I just want to add one more point while we're
Yes.
here. It was, I believe, around 1936 that the responsibility for First Nations people was changed from the Ministry of the Interior to the Department of Lands, Mines, and Resources. So you had CEOs of mining companies directly making policy about what to do with Indigenous people, like to move them around so that they could access Mother Earth and take whatever they wanted from her. Yeah.
That's tragic. And of course, we were talking 1957, that's not too long ago. And I assume this policy continued targeting the children of the communities of the nations up until the 1990s, or maybe even more recently. Dr. Richardson, can you clarify?
Oh yeah, it's still going on. So I have to,
Still going on.
qualify this by saying that I am a social work educator. I've taught at the University of Victoria,
Oh.
Université de Montréal, in the schools of social work. So I do participate in training social workers. And we really, like my colleagues and I really try to teach about anti-oppressive practice, how to work in a spirit of social justice, how to be culturally aware and sensitive, and to really respect the fact that children need to remain connected all the time to their family. And if their parent, for example, goes away for a while or is unavailable, that ch child should be remain in the fold of their family with their aunts and uncles or grandparents or neighbor, but they need to stay in their cultural community whenever that's possible and safe enough. And so we have a framework, there's hundreds of writers, authors, some indigenous, some non-indigenous that have good marked out good practice for child welfare work. And so often it's ignored. And there's lots of, reasons why it's hard to do the right thing, like make cultural plans for children. But most of the time it just doesn't happen. And, here in Quebec, for example, lots of social workers, it's the demographic of the place here. Many of them come from other places and aren't aware of this history. And then many from here are raised and socialized in the Quebec consciousness about, French state. And they just don't have an accurate view or a commitment to decolonization or social justice. And I'm generalizing, but you only need a handful of people to engage in colonial practice to destroy family after family after family. And so if you ask, like, why is there so many Indigenous people living on the street or suffering or committing suicide or,
Yes.
engaging in substance, this is why, because of this forced separation of children and their loved ones. And that's still continuing. So we really have to look at that if we're going to tell the truth about what's going on today.
Wow. I don't think people realize how relevant, how current this issue of, targeting children Indigenous children, First Nations, how current it is. People often think, colonization happened in a distant past. But in a lot of sense, for many Indigenous and First Nations peoples, I know, and maybe even a lot of minorities, even colonialism is relevant, living and present, almost an everyday violence that's pressed on you. But going beyond this a little bit, it almost seems as if when they take the children away and are giving them in the hands of the same state that has been the perpetuator of violence against First Nation peoples, they take away their connection to the land, to their ancestor. And then you mentioned with the alcoholism, they almost as if they replace that with they replace that dependency with culture, with nation, with ancestor, and then they introduce this element, the alcohol, the drugs, and whatnot, completely distorting that person's cultural connection to the land. And I mean, I can only imagine what a far-reaching effect psychologically, emotionally, this has, because I don't know, maybe from my experience, a lot of First Nation Indigenous peoples are highly connected with their land, highly connected with their ancestors and cultures. And when that is taken away or distorted in many ways, it leads to trauma upon trauma upon trauma for generations to come, what we call multi-generational trauma. Is that your experience with the First Nations and the Métis in Canada, Quebec? Do you find that like perpetuation of trauma because of this, dependency that was cut or dependency that was created, a fake dependency, or let's say on alcohol or drugs?
Well, I guess one of the things that I do is that I'm a family therapist. So I would say that people are breaking patterns just as often as they're perpetuating them. And so we always have to consider the fact, the presence of Indigenous resistance, whether it's the resistance of a child who is placed in a foster home and refuses to speak or eat, because basically they're on a hunger strike, to communities, to women that organize against the missing and murdered women issue. I don't want to just say that everyone's traumatized, because that's another discourse that the government really benefits from. And that's what social workers say often when they remove the ch children. Oh, the mother's so sad. She's crying. So she's traumatized because she went to residential school, so she can't parent. So I don't follow that logic from A to B. What I have to look at is all the mitigating factors. So all the things that people do to try to preserve their dignity, to keep their culture alive, to keep out colonial forces whenever they can, to like stand with the Wet'suwet'en, who are really getting brutalized, by the police and by mining companies and people that they really want to, build the pipeline and develop the oil and gas industry. And the Wet'suwet'en are just one people that are saying, this is our land. And no, you can't come on it. So if you look at all the violence from the state they're receiving, and you I guess find meaning in ideas like PTSD and trauma and all that, then you could say, yeah, in an ongoing way, the state is creating so much violence to really, really harm people, to get them out of the game, to get them off the land. But I just can't overlook the fact that people always respond in conditions of adversity. And you could look at any kind of occupation or oppression, and you see the things that people do to try to take care of each other, to share food, to make sure, if you hunt a moose, the community always makes sure that everyone, especially the elders, has enough to eat. So those, cultural practices carry on. And what communities really need is for other people to get off their back, as Ruth Ginsburg said, I don't need anything from you, just get your boot off my neck. That's, it's just stop interfering and honor the treaties that you signed with these Indigenous communities. Don't keep trying to steal their money. Pay. I mean, there's been, whatever, mining for I don't know how many years exactly, but they should have been paying the indigenous communities for all the activity on their land, all those kinds of things. So yes, there's a lot of injustice, and violence does hurt us. Like you can interview people from Ganasatage who were involved in the Mohawk resistance to the government invasion around 1990, and they can tell you how scary that was to have their community occupied with tanks and
Oh,
Canadian
sure.
soldiers and the Sûreté du Québec, like the police. You
Yes.
know, lots of people have stories about that, and they're still, it really did shake them up. But they still have their community, their traditions, their culture, their ceremonies. So, you know, it's a bit of everything, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
And is culture connecting with your culture, connecting with your heritage? Do you see that as a form of everyday resistance towards coloniality and colonial violence?
Well, I think so, and that it keeps us strong. You know, many people, every culture has their beliefs about the world, but also has spiritual belief. And so, indigenous people, I mean, indigenous people today, you have every kind of spirituality, really. You have people that have become Christian and they go to, Christian churches. You have people that practice traditional spirituality, which is like sweat lodges and ceremonies, and they really connect with their ancestors, and they think about like the gifts that have been handed down through the generations, not just the hard things, but the skills and knowledges. And then some people today, because of all the harm, they would say, maybe they would just say, I don't believe in anything or whatever, but traditional spirituality is big. A lot of communities have their longhouse or their big house or their traditional place where they ran their economy and their ceremonies and their politics and everything. So yes, I do think that, because it makes you strong, because you realize that I'm not just an individual. I'm a daughter, and I have a mother and a grandmother and a great grandmother and a great great grandmother, and it goes right back. And this is like, I don't know, thousands of women that love me. You know, they might be on the other side. Who knows? They might be living again, like reborn around me. They could be my neighbor, but they all love me, and they feel like, I think for my children's children that aren't born yet, you know. It's that idea that whenever you do something, you have to think of the seven generations in the future, as well as the seven generations behind you. So that's how we're supposed to make our decisions. What will be good and right for our, great, 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 great grandchildren when they get here. So I think that is a really powerful way to remain connected and to feel like you're not alone. So in the whatever, how many years, thousands of years that Indigenous people have been there, this period of colonization is just a blip on the radar,
Sure.
maybe 250 years. And maybe it'll change, and there'll be a massive revitalization of Indigenous ways, because our systems are failing right now. Maybe we will run out of oil, or we'll just have to live with the knowledge that we had to live before all this big development stuff, right?
And you know, a lot of that resilience that you mentioned is somehow, to me, it seems like it's rooted in the land. It's rooted in on, you know, onto the territories, onto the land or the earth, you might say. Can you speak to that, since you work with Indigenous First Nations communities and dealing with issues of overcoming trauma, breaking the trauma, and resilience? How does land, and particularly unceded territory, come into play here?
Yeah, well, in the Western world, you have a grocery store and a drug store and a swimming pool, and we have all this on the land. That what you know, the land was our pharmacy. The land was where we got our food, and the land was where we, swam and ran and hunted and rode horses, whatever it was. So there were that very practical element, but there's also a kind of cosmology that says that everything is alive. And so many indigenous traditions talk about our cousins, like the trees and the water and the birds and the insects, that they're all our relations, like we're all, well, we're all created of the same life force, and that we have a familial relationship. So this tree outside isn't just like some random tree. It's actually a presence that I can have a relationship with, and it witnesses my life and I witness its life, and it has sustenance for me or for people. So it's a different kind of relationship. We don't look at the world just as like in a capitalist way of products for consumption. You know, I would call mining earth rape, you know, like it's a different way. The Kaska women say you treat your women the way you treat the earth. And so when you go and see sort of land ripped up, it doesn't surprise you that there's a lot of violence around against women, particularly in areas around mining and man camps and pipelines and construction sites. So land means so much, but it's also, you know, it is your home. It's where you live, and your cultural knowledge and identity is actually related to the place that you live and your knowledge of that place. So people that have lived in the same kind of area for a long, long time, they know the land intimately, and they know, they can tell by reading nature, for example, if this is going to be a good time for fishing, what time should I go fishing, because you can tell by things that the birds are doing, or you know, sort of other signs around you. So it's just a bit an immense source of knowledge when you have land. And so land makes you strong and healthy. I can tell you that my grandma, Evelyn Oak, she lived on a trap line in Northwest Territories with my mom and two other little girls. My grandpa was also a trapper, and he traveled all around. And she said they never got sick. You know, it could be 30 below and they're outside and they made all their own clothes. But they were strong and robust and healthy, and everything they ate was healthy. They didn't have any Doritos or nacho chips and all that, you know?
Yes.
It's when you're alienated from the land that you know, your diet gets compromised. And today, so much of the drinking water is polluted. Even here in Montreal, so many homes have lead pipes. So we have lead in our water. Yeah. But all the communities across the north, you know, they haven't had clean drinking water coming out of a tap for a long time. Some people now who are 25 years old have never had water coming out of a tap that they could drink. So these are realities that the state has not addressed. And maybe there's lots of excuses why not. But, you know, if it was like rich people in downtown Toronto, they would try to clean it up really, really quickly, right?
Yeah, of course. Yes. And, you know, this is the issue with the water, especially, at least in Ontario, many of the reservations, you know, it's a big issue. Regardless, going back to land and then even the water itself, you know, when the water is polluted, there were studies, for example, done when the community's water systems are polluted, instances of violence, anxiety, and all kinds of things tend to be higher as well in those communities, which speaks to something that I think in, you know, in psychology, maybe what we call cultural psychology, is something that's you know, is really interesting for us. I mean, I study cultural psychology a little bit, but this relationship that individuals, humans, let's say, share as a community, as a person, as an individual with the land speaks to our psyche. And you can even say there, we are an extension of the land, or the land is an extension of our psyche in a lot of ways. But I feel that indigenous culture, First Nation culture, really captured this connections between the land and the person and the community. And even in the languages of First Nation peoples, you know, how we describe, how we relate to the land, there's this realization that we are a inherent part of this earth, and this earth is a living entity just like we are a living entity, and there's something called mutual constitution and don't want to get too academic, but like intersubjectivity between the land and the person and the sub and your own subjectivity. And I think that's something that maybe colonialism or colonial cultures have distorted. And for various reasons, you mentioned capitalism, the need for resources, expansionism, colonial enterprise. It's been distorted. Would you agree with that? And would that be a legacy of colonialism?
Yeah, well, Europeans came with a very different mindset. I'm talking about a certain kind of European, usually like an upper middle class English person. Of course, the people of the land, we used to call them peasants, but people that were farmers and lived on the land, they also had that kind of grounded connection in Europe as well. But I think when you're talking like this, I could acknowledge that the land here is actually literally made up of us. The dirt, when you think of all the ancestors that have lived here, all the generations, and when they died, they went to the earth, right? We go to the earth and we literally become the earth. And so our ancestors go back. If they go back thousands of years, someone was telling me the other day that they found settlements 36,000 years old in the States, but in the southern part of Turtle Island. So that's a lot of whatever it is, it's a long time. And so when we died, we literally ashes to ashes, death, we become the earth. So that earth is our ancestors, literally, but also just that we share that life force and that spirit. And there's lots of teachings about also different elementals and spirit beings that exist, like the life force within a plant, for example, is also alive, has a consciousness, and people respect that. It's kind of like animism. Everything is alive. And so even in the Cree language, if I am going to talk about different nouns, I use a different article in front of it based on whether that material is alive, like a rock wall, for example, or if it's not alive, not animate. And so looking at everything around us, in its animation or life force is built into many languages because it's part of the consciousness, the awareness of our relations, all our relations.
And it's really fascinating because I work with First Nation Indigenous peoples across the Americas, and I noticed that it's the way people relate to it, the culture, the language. It's very different than our Eurocentric language systems, cultural systems, and it could be very healing. One last, I mean, we are coming to a near the end of our podcast, unfortunately. I mean, there's a lot to talk about, but coming back to this quote unquote the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, aka Orange Shirt Day, how do we honor truth? How do we honor peacemaking with the First Nation Indigenous peoples? So what is the significance? I mean, if you want to say, if it, you know, how do we decolonize this day and to really truly honor the First Nation Indigenous peoples on this day?
Okay, so one thing is learn about whose indigenous land that you're living on and how your family got there. Maybe look into what the relations were like between your ancestors, the early settlers here, and the indigenous people. Try to be an ally. That means respecting the boundaries. Don't ask too many questions. Don't ask to come to ceremonies. But if you build meaningful relationships with people, you might get invited in, and I think that's something really special. I would say support Indigenous businesses if you're going to, if you want to buy earrings or clothing or things that are indigenous, make sure the online business that you deal with is run by indigenous people. Don't buy like dream catchers that come from China. Don't go into new age shops and buy sage, you know, if it's like a hippie shop.
Sure.
It's cool, but the money, but they're taking indigenous culture and profiting from it. So do those kinds of things, like be respectful, think about where things come from. And then when you die, you can bequeath your land back to the indigenous people that it belonged to. And I'm not saying, you know, you're not going to get kicked out of your home, but when you don't need it anymore, you can write in your will. And lots of people are doing that, both in what we call Canada and the United States. I've been collecting examples, because when you're dead, you don't need it.
I'm sorry. And does the state abide by this? So if a person would write in the will that they want to return the land to their original inhabitants or the original owners of the, would the state or the province abide by that will?
It's not their business. It's just between me and the community. So if I say I'm going to leave my house to the, you know, Ganawage Band Council or whatever, I can do that. In Victoria, BC, for example, an elderly couple had a few homes in Oak Bay, which is kind of like a posh, it used to be English area. They donated both their houses to the Native Friendship Center. And so the Native Friendship Center can use those for whatever they want to for services. So you don't really need the permission of the state. I mean, some of the things the state does have been helpful, you know, like maybe having this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because a lot of people were really glad to tell their story. Like they felt, oh, finally. But unfortunately, their story ended up in some paper on a shelf, just sitting there, and they're probably shredding them all. And, you know, like, my story is sacred. What happened to it? And, you know, there's other problems with it that we didn't have time to talk about. Like, there's no accountability for the priests that did all that violence. You know, they really got off easy. So anyway, that's another thing. But yes, you can decide if you want to leave your property. And actually, a lot of people that do it are farmers and ranchers, because you listen to the interviews, they say, my family's had a good livelihood on this land. You know, we've raised our children, we've grown food, we've had a good life, and we've learned more about whose land it really was, and they give it back. So that's one thing you can do, you know, if you want to. Sure. You know, we're tired of telling, you know, the mainstream population what to do, but they can, you know, people always say, what can I do to help? Well, you can do your own research about what could be the decolonizing act, and, you know, educate yourself about the past. But those are concrete things that you can do, right?
Absolutely. No, that's really, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And in the spirit, I mean, and we're talking about this day, a particular day, and it doesn't have to be a day. I think we're here on Turtle Island. I think we have, as citizens, you know, I remember I'm taking an oath to the Queen. I remember her picture very vividly. For some reason, I remember her picture really big in front of my face for my citizenship. And then, you know, the story of the First Nations was always missing in the great immigration story of the peoples that come here. I feel like this shouldn't be a one day thing. It should be an everyday practice, and somehow we need to learn to reconnect with the spirit of the Turtle Island, with the ancestors of the Turtle Island, and one, to honor the people who work, but also as a means of our own decolonization, you know, mentally, psychologically, emotionally, physically even. And it is, you know, I think this is a necessary process, and for us to you know, overcome some of these challenges that we're facing today, environmentalism, you know, environmental issues, climate change, environmental degradation, war. You know, sometimes we support wars of you know, colonial wars today without really realizing it. You know, infighting, self-destruction, things like that. What's your opinion on that?
Oh, well, I guess like those are big things. Everyone will say, oh, the world's going to whatever. But I think to work from the inside out, you know, like do your own work, really learn about who you are and your purpose in life. Why are you here? And, you know, basically, what is the minimum that I need to live so that I can share my bounty with my extended family and community and my neighbors and have a more collective view? Because there's always pockets of care and, like I was saying, you know, revolutionary love or resistance amongst people in the face of these sort of big catastrophes. I've had other people say to me, you know, what can we do? And they're professionals. And I say, well, if you really want to know, you and a group of people could go to a high school and ask the teacher or a principal to identify a Indigenous student in grade 11 or grade 12 who is mediocre in their studies. They're not bad. They're not the highest. And a group of you can adopt that student in an educational sense and offer to pay his university tuition, something like that. Right. Like you have to start with younger people, and the ones that get really good grades, they'll get scholarships. The ones that are in the middle, if you told somebody in grade 11, you know, we're a group of counselors or educators, and there's about 10 of us, and we're going to support you through your studies, if you want tutoring, or if you want to go to college or university, we're going to help you raise the tuition. That would give somebody a lot of hope, and they would actually try harder and maybe get there. Those are things that people can do. You don't have to adopt a child in Burundi through you know, Canadian Christian adopt a child abroad. You know, we have to be careful with these things too. You don't want to set up a lot of competition, but if a student, an Indigenous student, has made it to grade 11, they love basketball. Maybe they might be the first one in their family to ever go to university. Those are really concrete things that people can do, as long as you don't get colonial in how you approach it, right? We can't be too attached to the outcome and bossy, but just come in with an open heart and an open spirit and say, you know, we'd like to offer this.
That's really important. I mean, these are tangible things that, you know, we could do on an everyday basis. You know, concerning your time and coming to a really end of the podcast, I hope we can keep this conversation going. This is a really important conversation for our community, of course, in Canada. But again, given the time, we have to close this. So I'm going to give the last word to you, Dr. Kathy. If you have any closing remarks before we part.
Yeah, well, I guess just to say, you know, if you go out around the city and you see an Indigenous person on the street, just to try to be compassionate and understand all the violence and all the obstruction that resulted, you know, from the mainstream culture that resulted in that person getting there, and all the benefit that, you know, upper middle class citizens took, how some people really benefited from the things that were stolen from Indigenous people, and hold that kind of compassion and awareness rather than just judging people.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Dr. Kathy, for joining me on this podcast. Hope to see you again very soon. Thank you to my audience for following us, and looking forward to our future meetings. Thank you.
Hi, hi. Take good care.